This is Commander Gilmore, U.S. Strategic Command, and General Borshevsky, Russian intelligence.
Russian intelligence? Are you mad?
A lot's happened since you were frozen. The Cold War's over.
Well, finally those capitalist pigs will pay for their crimes, eh? Hey, comrades? Hey?
Austin, we won.
Oh, groovy, smashing. Yay, capitalism.
Knowledge of history is like knowledge of your own life. You are partially amnesia if you don't know what happened.
You always say that let us not get caught in the past and the future. Let us go back to the present moment.
But here's what I'm wondering. Are we just seeing history repeat itself?
Have you ever taken us out? Because maybe you should.
Hello, welcome to ACFM, the home of the weird left. I'm Jeremy Gilbert, and I'm joined, as usual, by my friends Nadia Idle.
Hi.
And Keir Milburn.
Hello.
And I'm going to take a moment to do what we keep failing to do on these shows, and mention that the show is produced by Matt Full, is edited by Olivia Humphreys and Matt Huxley, and we really couldn't be doing this without them, and they are as much part of the ACFM idea as we are. So Keir, what are we doing today?
Okay, so today we're addressing the question of why now? What is it about the current conjuncture? What is it about the present state of things that makes us think that the time is right for an acid communist, or actually more specifically an acid Corbynist politics, right? This is ACFM, so we also want to discuss this not just through the point of view of political economy. We want to discuss it from how it feels to live in late neoliberalism, what contemporary experience feels like, and what aspects of that experience make us think that an acid Corbynist politics could be both attractive and potentially effective. And of course, we need to address the converse of that, right? What elements of that experience might lead us away from an AC politics, or might make an acid Corbynist politics potentially less effective than we'd like? You know, it's not an easy question to answer. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to be sure that your politics actually do address the present. Right? It's not easy to be sure that your politics aren't in fact informed by some sort of legacy politics from a previous era. So we also want to discuss concepts such as left melancholy, which are designed to help us address that question. You know, the question of how difficult it is to address the present, how difficult it is to be here now, as the early psychedelic guru Richard Alpert or Ram Dass put it in 1971.
Let the past go with the forgiveness, and let the future go with no anticipation.
Well, firstly, what do we mean by this term, conjuncture? It refers to the sort of the convergence of events and sort of relations of power shaping any particular moment at a particular time, and to some extent in a particular place. And it is deliberately sort of ambivalent. Like there's no fixed timescale for a conjuncture. So I only realised this a few weeks ago, but Stuart Hall, for example, in the same book at one point, in his book The Hard Road to Renewal, he uses the term conjuncture for historical moments that last several decades, and also that just seem to last a few weeks. But I think, look, basically, the question of conjuncture is always just the question of what is specific about the present, like as compared to the past, and when does the present start as we conceive it? So what is it that defines now, and when does now start? And if I ask you, like Yanadi, like how you think about that, I mean, how would you answer it? Like, what do you think are the sort of specific characteristics of our moment, and when do you think of that moment as sort of beginning, like, and some previous moment having given way to it? Or do you not think about that at all?
No, I do think about that. I mean, I think one of the things that makes today or the times that we live in different, there's several things. One is the lack of acceptance of historicity as like being normal. So that thing of like, it's normal that people don't know kind of like where they come from or how things have come to be, or you know, what struggles happened beforehand, or like what's the history of your class, or how did the social and material conditions happen. Like, I would argue, and or I'd make a gamble to say that that is part of what what living under neoliberalism is. And part of the kind of excitement of the political project of people getting involved in politics is like discovering this whole like European and, you know, North American, but also like world history and past of like, oh my God, things haven't always been this way. So that's one thing. The other thing is the in terms of the interaction of mental health and time with activism and change, I think is really important in terms of how people experience time and how much space they have in their brains and why the kind of juxtaposition of communism with acid there is really important, is that there has to be a mind-expanding consciousness inflation part to any political project, which effectively is about trying to keep you sane when things are around you are changing at a pace, not necessarily a fast pace, but, you know, the way fascism makes itself known is not the way that people imagine it to be made known. And in the same way, the kind of consciousness deflation happens slowly and slowly and slowly. And so we're seeing both things at the same time. I think it's both a time, really exciting time for politics and for people, you know, in their 20s. And it's also like there are forces of capital behind which is kind of goose stepping forward.
I mean, I think that's all really useful. The one thing I would say is about the ahistoricity thing. This is sort of paradoxical, but I think it's a really common misconception right now. And it's a misconception that Mark really did a lot to reproduce, to be honest, which is that somehow that ahistoricity is specific to the present. Because if you go back to the mid-19th century, like Marx is saying exactly the same thing then. He's saying, well, people don't know history. And that the function of ideology is to make sure people don't know history, so that they don't realise that social relations are contingent and can be changed.
That's interesting.
And then most of the main theorists of ideology, like Gramsci and Althusser in the 20th century, they both said, look, Althusser said very specifically, this is the historically invariant feature of all ideology. Like, you go back to the early classical times, and the function of ideology is to convince people that the Athenian city-state is just like this universal form, which has always been like that and couldn't be any different. But you're not wrong. I mean, at the sort of subjective and political level, of course, historicising and sort of becoming aware of history is really crucial to any kind of radicalisation. But I would just say, well, it always was. Like, it was a huge deal for the workers' movement, like all through the 19th and 20th century, to teach people history and to get people to get a sense of their history and develop a kind of radical history. So there's no question that is really important. But I think what is specific about the neoliberal moment is that the neoliberal hegemony was so successful. It was very, very successful in kind of making people dehistoricize. But ideology is always trying to do that, I think.
I think what I'm trying to say is, in people's lived experience in their communities, and I'm very careful when I use the term communities because people use that term a lot, and for most people, people don't have a community. But there was a time, I believe, and I might be wrong, but there was a time where there was more community. So people grew up in certain places and knew more of the people around them, and that people were less uprooted in a sense. Again, I might be wrong. And that's where I mean the history comes from, is that there is a history of, you know, whether this community being particularly conservative or this is the way we do things around here. That also was a logic that existed for a lot of the left. Like, we are the left because culturally we are the left and we are belonging to this class. Now, both the unrootedness of people in a very literal sense with the physical place of where they live in you know, many parts of the West, and definitely for people in, you know, the UK in cities, has a specific interaction with the perceived dissolution of class.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. But I think, I mean, I've got to say, I think a particular image is haunting that account, and it's the sort of idealised image of the working class community in struggle. So, like, if you're talking about miners in South Wales, then what you're saying is completely right. But they were never typical of, like, the broader working class, and they were certainly never typical of the broader population. Like, there was never a moment when, like, most people had a clear sense of their own history and of their classes and their class as a class or their class as a history. But I think what you're getting at actually is important, because it's very difficult to even give people that sense of historicity when there isn't even a community to learn the history of. I think.
Yeah.
There's another bit thing that's missing though, isn't there? So the classic thing was always that the party was the memory of the working class, basically. And so it was left institutions which would carry the memory of struggle, do you know what I mean? And then be able to help people position their own lives within history. So that might be a way in which you could sort of, we could resolve your point with Mark Fisher's point, because what really does collapse is the continuity of the left. That's what collapses under neoliberalism.
Well, it does, but that continuity had only existed for a couple of generations, I would say.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was always a problem with Mark and with people like Simon, you know, who was very close to Reynolds, as they were always treating basically post-war culture or mid-20th century culture as if it was some kind of historical norm, you know, from which everything else was a catastrophic deviation. And it wasn't true. It's more accurate to say, well, after decades, really a century of struggle, like for a couple of generations, we had these relatively stable working class communities in struggle. We had constantly innovating popular music. You know, we had social democratic progress. And it is really important to get that, because it's important to, and this comes back to the question of conjuncture, that actually what we're living through now is more normal for the history of capitalism.
Yeah.
What we're living through now is more like normal capitalism than what people had in the mid-20th century for a few decades into the end of the 20th century.
Let me just say that I think that Nadia's point about like mental health and a lack of historicity, right, they are related in that, and I think it's sort of, that's a good way of thinking about our project. In the only way that I can keep sane or keep from getting depressed, etc., is because I understand the present moment in terms of history. Do you know what I mean? I see it as, oh yeah, okay, so this is what's going on now. You know, I can see this. You know, if I look back at the previous, you know, some of the previous big crises. I think we're still in the middle of this big crisis period, provoked by the 2008 and the great financial crisis that came after it. You know, there was one of those in the 1970s, there was one of those in the 1930s. You know, if we look at the 1930s, you know, there's a big crisis, starts in 1929. You know, if you look like 10 years on, you've got Hitler, Mussolini, you know, basically things are not looking nice around the world. You know what I mean? These things produce, you know, you get these epochal moments of abuse, big periods of struggle, but it takes a long time before you see what the new iteration of capitalism perhaps is going to look like, and what the new left, which is going to be adequate to that, is going to look like. And I see we're in the middle of that moment now, right, where there's new, you know, a new left is trying to emerge, and we're trying to be, you know, we're trying to help that birthing process. And part of what we're doing by that is saying, it's by saying, you know, look at all of these things like mindfulness, you know, microdosing so that you can be more creative, you know, all of this sort of like Silicon Valley sort of version of psychedelia, etc. All of these things, we're saying, look, these had a different history, a history which shows it could have a different path now. Do you know what I mean? Part of that different history is that, you know, this could be turned into a left project, as it was in moments, just in, you know, in potential in the 1960s and 1970s. So that my understanding of the present conjuncture is really that, is that we're in the middle of this long extended period of crisis, you know, which we've seen in the past in the 1930s and the 1970s. They took about 25 years before you could see what the new world would look like, which was emerging out of those crises. You know, it took a long time for that to come around. Perhaps not 25 years, 20 years, something like that.
I mean, Keir, the point about, you know, knowing history to stay sane and not get depressed, I think is totally crucial. I don't think you can really stay sane in the present moment without understanding how totally fucked things have been at several points since the Industrial Revolution, really. Things are not as fucked now as they were even in the 30s, to be honest.
Yeah.
They're really not. You know, we've still got a National Health Service, even though it's on its knees. You know, my you know, it's a cliche, I know, but my grandmother went to school in bare feet, you know. Things are not as fucked, and they're definitely not as fucked as they were. I mean, people in the late 18th, sort of 19th century, living in cities, were just living in abject squalor, working 18 hours a day. Kids were going down. You know, kids were working in factories and coal mines. And there was an, and as far as we can tell from the historical evidence, almost nobody was sane. I mean, people were just fucking nuts. You know, people were just, it was just a horrible, brutal way to live. So it is really important to keep that in mind. And it's really important not just to focus on what's been lost. When I was doing a talk in Cardiff about acid Corbynism, I got a question from the floor, you know, from a young woman about how I thought acid Corbynism related to, or what its connection could be with, the kind of recent revival of interest in jazz, especially by sort of young people, sort of young musicians. And I was a bit diffident, and I said, you know, well, in my experience, it's a jazz revival every 10 years or so. I'm not yet to see how far this is going to go. I always want there to be, because I sort of love jazz, and I sort of do... I think it's a really obvious reasons why, in some ways, it's the sort of definitive radical, modern radical music, because it's always an exploration of sort of collective, you know, agency and, you know, free, you know, collectivity and freedom at the same time. But I think that has, it's pretty undeniable now. So in London, in Britain, and in the States, there's been a really, just in the past 3 or 4 years, a kind of explosion of really innovative jazz, you know, wave of sort of young women performers, really for the first time. People kind of, you know, producers and musicians evoking the kind of radical sort of psychedelic jazz of the early 70s in a really convincing way for the first time since that moment, I think. Probably the kind of the sort of darlings of the kind of current young London jazz scene are this group, Sons of Kemet, and there's this track, which is a partially spoken word track, Your Queen is a Reptile. Slightly surreal, very obviously kind of anti-establishment, anti-authoritarian, sort of anti-colonialist in its tone.
Challenge. Well, now we come on to our third round. Our contestant tonight is Karl Marx, and our special prize is this beautiful lounge suite. Now, Karl has elected to answer questions on workers' control of factories, so here we go with question number one.
In my Generation Left book, I sort of take up Marx and the 18th Brumaire, where he talks about, you know, he's got the famous thing about, you know, history happens first as tragedy, second time as farce. But then he goes on to make this analysis where he's saying, you know, whenever people sort of like have this chance to revolutionize everything, whenever they try to make something really new, they tend to be anxious and adopt the clothing and the demands and the sort of political frame of previous generations, of dead generations, he says, and that weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living.
You mean here Marx as in Karl rather Karl than Marx as in Fischer, not, because they sound the same on this recording.
Yes, we must say not Fischer, we must say Karl Marx.
Yeah,
Karl Marx, the 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon and of Louis Bonaparte. He was writing about 1848, this whole cycle of revolutions, and he was thinking, you know, when these revolutions break out in across Europe, they, in 1848, they think, they pick up all the slogans and all of the framings from 1789, which is the French Revolution, do you know what I mean? And, like, you can understand that in various ways, but the way I understand it is, you know, that just tends to be what happens, you know, you tend to create something which is new by repeating what's gone before, But in a way which opens up to the new. So the key is, like, let's not make it a farcical repetition. A farcical repetition is where you just pick it up and you repeat it, even though you repeat all the bits that don't actually fit with how life is lived now. It doesn't fit with the present conjuncture. In fact, you need a non-farcical repetition where you can pick up those things and then see how they relate to the present moment. And I think that's what the AC Project is. We've got to make the AC Project a non-farcical repetition of the 1960s and 1970s, basically. And I think that is what we're trying to do. It is.
Well then, Carl, one final question in that beautiful, non-materialistic lounge suite will be yours. Already, Carl? You're a brave man. Your final question. Who won the English Football Cup in 1949?
The workers control the means of production. The struggle of the urban proletariat.
No, it was Wolverhampton Wanderers who beat Leicester 3-1.
Oh, shit.
Get out of here.
Okay, so who would be the subjects who would be more amenable to an acid communist analysis, and who would be to totally reject them, right? I think that's something we could move on to discuss.
Who will take it up? Like, who's the constituency? Well, the core constituency is, you know, what the sociologist Guy Standing calls the precariat. It's the kind of young, mostly young, although increasingly not that young, sort of mostly sort of graduates, you know, sort of disenfranchised by the contractions of the labour market, and but also absolutely so immersed in kind of post-1960s and neoliberal kind of libertarian culture that they're not going to embrace a sort of socially conservative reaction against neoliberalism, which, you know, a lot of commentators over the past few years, and we've mentioned this before on the show, a lot of commentators have thought that the natural reaction against the failures from neoliberalism would be some sort of restoration, some kind of return to certain kind of social conservatism. And certainly in many communities around the world, that's happened. I mean, that's been the basis for the rise of certain kinds of religious fundamentalism, for example. But I think we're saying that AC sort of, I think, expresses almost the natural politics of sort of generations, or a generation in the kind of macro sense that you kind of hint at or explain in the book here, whereby a generation isn't just 20-odd years. Generation left in Britain is now pretty much everyone under 52. It's according to the opinion polls, you know, it's now 52 is the cutoff age below which, you know, if you look at people's ideas about the way the world works and their policy preferences, they're basically libertarian socialists. I think in sort of sociological terms, one thing that's sort of interesting to observe, and it comes back to some of Keir's points, is it was actually John Trickett, like senior Labour MP, first said to me a few years ago, oh, one of the things we've got to think about is the changing composition of the middle class. And he said, I think in the long term, conservatism has a real problem, because the traditional base of conservatism for 150 years was the petty bourgeoisie, the kind of the intermediary layers between the capitalist class and the working class. And they were historically very, very conservative. And one of the things lots of sociologists have picked up on from the 60s onwards is one of the things that happens after the 60s, and indeed with the kind of neoliberal reaction to the 60s, is quite broad sections of the so-called middle classes, that even kind of small business owners, people working in tech, people working in media, as well as the kind of public sector professional classes that we all sort of belong to, is that they become really libertarian. Is they all that traditional conservatism completely stops being part of their composition. And I still think it's the case today, you know, what the group I sometimes call the new petty bourgeoisie, you know, the sort of people working in or even running like small businesses, people in media, people in tech, they're sort of politically up for grabs, I think. They were sort of the core constituency for the Third Way. But that's partly because Blair and Clinton were the first people ever to try to really, you know, appeal to them. And I think they're sort of open, a lot of them, to a politics which is socialistic, providing it's also sort of hedonistic and libertarian. Providing it isn't, they don't think it's going to make them have to wear hair shirts and, you know, join a Maoist kind of work commune or something. So part of it is that, I think, and the strategy for our strand of the left more broadly, actually, is to sort of talk to those people and say, look, you're never going to be Mark Zuckerberg, you know, so you're really better off throwing in your lot with, you know, manual workers and precarious workers, etc., to the extent that you're all going to get, you know, shorter working weeks, you know, universal basic income, you know, and a green planet to live on.
I worry that all of those people are Lib Dems.
Yeah, well, they might. They can. This is, well, we've seen that the whole point of the past 2 years is they can be Lib Dems. They can vote for Corbyn.
Mm.
That's the whole point. They did vote for Corbyn. Right now, they're all saying they're going to vote Lib Dem or Green. A lot of them have gone to the Greens. That's the whole point. The whole reason why I actually acid Corbynism, not just acid communism, is an important political idea in the current, you know, conjuncture is precisely. It's one of the things we've learned over the past 2 years is that people like, you know, me, and I don't think any of us would have disagreed, was saying for the past 3 years is the constituency Labour seems to be most bothered about losing, like leave voting, you know, former miners over 60 in Yorkshire was not the only constituency they had to worry about keeping on side. They also need to worry about keeping on side, you know, libertarian, hedonistic, you know, computer programmers who go and do iHusker. Because there are more of them than there are former miners now, and they will vote for Corbyn, and they will desert Corbyn for, you know, the Greens and the Lib Dems. Yeah, if you don't appeal to them. So, in that sense, yeah, acid Corbynism on that level it is pretty serious, I think.
There's always a point, isn't there, where resolve and family. Responsibilities sort of take precedence and things sort of people disperse and then you're left with that sort of vacuum of, well, was it actually worth it?
One of the other aspects of like this new generation left politics is, I think, a level of pragmatism and openness to sort of like the idea that you need to strategize for how you actually change the world, which is not present from a lot of the people I've done politics with in the 90s, etc. We didn't have to think about strategy at that point because we were also caught in this, even though I was involved in radical politics in the 90s and early 2000s, we were still caught in this general picture that like radical change is not possible. So you don't have to think about strategy, etc. I mean, and all of this is a way through to sort of thinking about this problem of left melancholy, which we said we'd discussed.
Yeah.
I mean, left melancholy, I mean, Keir can talk about it more than I can, really, but it's this melancholy, it refers to Sigmund Freud's classic description of melancholy as like the opposite of, in some sense, of mourning. And mourning is when you realise that the thing you loved is gone and you sort of deal with it. A melancholy is when you can't deal with it. You somehow can't quite let go. You can't quite move on beyond this state of kind of depression because the thing is gone. And I remember sort of trying to theorise Britpop, for example, in terms of that. This sense that Britpop was all about this endless nostalgia for 1966, which is a perfectly rational moment to be nostalgic for. It was literally, you know, it was the high point of the post-war settlement before unemployment starts to skyrocket again and before deindustrialization starts to kick in. But it was a completely crap way of processing that. It was just this crap, apolitical evocation of the sort of music and culture of 1966 without any sort of political critique of like what, you know, what had made it go away. Here, you talk about left melancholy.
Well, Wendy Brown takes up this idea of from Freud's of the distinction between melancholy and mourning, and she sort of takes it from Walter Benjamin as well, who's obviously writing in a dark time for the left, right? He's writing in the 1930s, and in fact, he commits suicide on the border between France and Spain because he thinks he can't get into Spain and away from the Nazi forces which are invading France. So that's a politics of, you know, of melancholia and the defeat of hope. And so that gets picked up by Wendy Brown, and she's writing in 1999. She starts to talk about left melancholia, and she's sort of talking about how the left at that point, it can't accept the big defeats it can't mourn the big defeats that it had undergone in the late 1980s and into the early 1990s. It couldn't mourn that and then move on. It was trapped in a sort of in an attachment to politics from another age, right? It couldn't, if it could mourn those defeats and mourn that, it could adjust itself towards the new conjuncture, right? The new conjuncture that was there at the time, and instead it couldn't do that. And so the left got attached to, or at least parts of the left got attached to the impossibility of change got attached to, attached to the impossibility of a left politics more than and detached from the potential of a left politics.
You mean only like being in opposition, right? So can we be a little bit more explicit about?
Well,
what
it's not just only being in opposition. It's sort of like the repetition of forms of thinking and the forms of acting. You know, social movement forms, the forms of politics, which no longer had any ability to affect the world. But you just keep repeating them over and over
because that's what they did in the good days, you mean?
Well, so partly, but that's what melancholy is. It's like you cannot let this a lost object go, and so you just do the things that we've always done. Yeah, you do the things that are always done because, you know, you can't let it go. It's an attachment. It's like, she calls it a structure of desire, right? You know, our desires make us compulsively repeat these things to make the mere semblance that world hasn't gone, you know, even though it has.
I've got to admit, I was never clear like which left she was talking about.
I think she's talking about the radical left, basically. I think she's talking about the radical left in the 1990s. I sort of recognise it now when I look back. You know, I even see the radical, because 1999, there's a big demonstration in Seattle against the World Trade Organization, and that sparked off a sort of big wave of protests and social forums. And it was like the reemergence of the left after a very, very bleak period in the 1990s, right? But like when we look back now, we see it was totally, and it was like, we could say that 1999 and that whole anti-globalisation movement was the first attempts where people were really trying to break with the past and create a left which was adequate to the times, to start to address the times. But it was soaked in left melancholia. You definitely have to say that when you look back now, because strategy wasn't really seriously discussed. You know, the key slogan of the anti-globalisation movement was "Another world is possible," but there was very little discussion of how you move from now and make that possible world actual. There was little of that.
So that's part of the melancholy, the fact that it wasn't strategic. Is that what you mean? I'm getting completely confused.
Yeah, that's one of the symptoms. Yeah. Because you're not looking at the world and saying, how do I change? You're not looking at the conjuncture and saying, this is the conjuncture, these are the possibilities, how do we act to move those possibilities in a socialist direction? You know, you're compulsively repeating your habitual patterns of behaviour in order to maintain the illusion that the world that you mourn has not, is still there.
Well, there's an interesting little lineage here. So, you know, I mean, I wrote a book called Anti-Capitalism and Culture in 2008, which is really a sort of response partly to being involved in things like the sort of post-Seattle anti-globalization. But, you know, my key bit in that was what I called the critique of the activist imaginary, which was precisely defined by the refusal of what I called a strategic orientation. So it was this complete inability, and it was absolutely typical, that I thought, of that moment. And also, like, groups that Keir was in, actually, people like Turbulence, had sort of were trying this little sort of affinity groups were trying to also make some critique of the fact that it really did become the case. If you were around that kind of anti-globalisation, anti-capitalist scene, the things coming out of Reclaim the Streets in London in the late 90s, early 2000s, it really did get to a point where you weren't allowed to use the word strategy. People had the attitude that if you said the word strategy, you were a Stalinist, that the only way to be a good kind of libertarian, horizontal activist was literally just not to think about it. And so Keir's developed this argument quite recently, which I think is really persuasive, that that's also a symptom in some ways of the same thing as like the Trots, even though it's more obvious with the Trots, just basically trying to exactly mimic the behaviour of Russian revolutionaries in 1910. That refusal of strategy was also about the fact that, well, if you couldn't imagine, you just really just couldn't imagine actually winning. You couldn't imagine actually making any progress. So you just refuse the very demand to do so.
But isn't that also about the two things there, about both culture and opportunism? And culture, when I say culture, I mean like it's about identity. It's like we are anti-globalization activists because this is the tradition that we come from, and therefore these are the tactics which we use,
yeah,
which I guess is our critique of why people who are like, oh, Corbynism is all electioneering, I can't believe that you radicals are like going into like party politics. It's that same thing. It's like basically saying, your culture should tell you how you should behave, how you should speak, whether you're selling papers or whether you're blockading police lines. Like, that's what determines it, rather than
culture, though. I think perhaps tradition is more classical way of saying, this is my left tradition and my left tradition does things this way.
And also
it became an identity. I mean, I think if you're talking about the early 2000s anti-capitalist movement, there wasn't much of a tradition to it. I mean, if there was, it was coming out of things like Earth First in the 80s. It was more that it was an identity. My critique of it, of what I call the activist imaginary, was just a kind of theoretical elaboration of this quite famous essay that was published in this weird little Marxist paper out of Brighton at the end of the 90s called Alf Haben. And it was an essay called Give Up Activism. And it was really sort of powerful for me. And it said, look, the whole... You know, because it was all about this. It was a critique of the fetishization of the activist as an identity. And the thing is, now it has. I mean, Keir's right. It's completely gone. I keep saying this to people at the moment. I keep finding myself saying to people, look, if you think the left has got any kind of problems now, you know, in terms of its internal culture, it's light years ahead of where it was then, because it was just ridiculous. I mean, most people who were in any way active had this totally fetishized sense of themselves as an activist, and it was more important to kind of prove to yourself and your friends that you were a good activist than it was to win any new recruits to the cause, to actually persuade anybody of anything. And it was totally fucked, you know. It was, and it just got nowhere. I'm using that word far too often today.
But what I was going to say, my second point on opportunism is that, you know, there's often a political moment that you can't see coming with all.
I don't
of
think
these
you
things.
Mean opportunity. You mean opportunity, don't you?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean opportunity.
You're right.
In the sense of like with Tahrir, you know, when the Egyptian Revolution happened, like they toppled a dictator or any government for the first time in 7,000 years, and then there was a huge vacuum, and everyone was like, what the fuck? Because people didn't think it was going to happen, but they pushed forward with it anyway. And that was not a movement that came from a specific tradition or culture in that sense. It's just sometimes there's an opportunity and it will be followed by a vacuum, and then it will create another set of conditions.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the kind of hard truths about which conjunctural analysis can lead you to, which is often very hard to take, that often the scope for political action is limited. Often there isn't that much you can do. Like, it's not really clear that from that whole period, from the mid-80s up to about 2008, that there was really much anybody could do apart from sort of kick off, you know, stop traffic, you know, make a fuss. I mean, to some extent, I mean, my understanding of, you know, what any kind of useful left activity was doing for most of that period was it was just keeping stuff going until another opportunity arose.
Mm.
I mean, right now it's an interesting moment because we don't really know what the scope of our kind of opportunities are. We don't, but clearly after 2008, and clearly what's happened with Corbyn becoming Labour leader and then the 2017 election result, was it's quite clear now that although we don't know exactly how much we can get done in this moment, we can clearly get something, we can demonstrably get some things done that were totally impossible for like 30 years. So if we're talking about, you know, melancholy in, you know, recent sort of music, then probably the greatest exponent of a pretty explicitly melancholic musical project was Burial. Coming out of the dubstep scene, but the music is just explicitly riddled with this nostalgic evocation of sort of rave culture of the early 90s, even though it's made in the kind of mid-2000s by someone who, you know, would have been a small child if he was around at all in the early 90s. For me, it was always it's kind of weird because I was sort of hanging out on the sort of hardcore rave scene, which this music sort of evokes as now this sort of paradisical lost moment of London's dance culture.
Oh.
part of the reason it's hard to know how much can be done is, you know, how much of like left melancholy are we carrying around with us? Do you know what I mean?
I'm carrying absolutely zero. Can I just say? I think we're going to win.
Great.
I think we're going to win. I think we're going to win. I completely believe in the Martin Luther King quote of like the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. Like, I think we're going to win. I thought we're going to win since I started, when I became a left-wing person. And that is basically, yeah, that is what I believe. I think it's really fucking difficult, but I think we're going to win. And that is central to how I do my politics, whereas I completely see that there's all of these different left groups out there who they don't think they're going to win. Just don't believe it. Yeah. And I believe it.
One interesting thing at the moment is, if you're going to look around and look for like that form of political melancholy now, you would say centrist melancholy is like rife. Do you know? Like, you know, yeah, that it's exactly the same pattern,
yeah,
of behaviour.
Yeah.
Complete inability to recognise that 2008 is happening. So basically, it's this complete blindness to anything that's gone on, because you can't recognise 2008 has happened and fundamentally changed things and destroyed the economic base of this electoral coalition and the electoral politics, or the politics that a lot of these people, the centrist dads, the 90s comedians,
grew up with. That's right, yeah.
And so, you know, and that's why a lot of their politics looks like acting out, you know, because it's not about what's the situation in the world, how do we change things, how do we move things towards our politics. It's just acting out. It's like a temper tantrum.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when there were plenty of Labour Party branches still being run by the militant tendency, even after they'd been, you know, roundly defeated in the party, and as, you know, history was hurtling towards 1989. And the behaviour of like the right, the kind of Blairite right, who still run my local Labour Party, really reminds me of them more than anything else. You know, it's really similar. That they can't believe it. And it's also, even if they did believe it, they don't know what else to do apart from just keep attacking the left and trying to hold on. Because I think you're right. I think centrist melancholy is a massive problem for us, because they won't accept that they've been defeated. They won't move on and like figure out what to do. They try and figure out how to act strategically. I mean, I would also say I have no left melancholy, because I am no question that I am in fucking mourning for the defeat of the working class. Like, I have been since 1985, so I don't make any secret of it. And, you know, honestly, I do, like, you know, I probably think about the miners' strike and literally shed a little tear, you know, every couple of weeks, you know, and have done all my life. I probably always will. So. But that is better. I would say that is better, just dealing with it, except that the left. It's really important, I think, for left strategy today to accept we suffered a catastrophic defeat in the mid-80s. It was so catastrophic that it was always going to have taken 50 years to recover from it. And I think we are, you know, that far into the recovery. I think that, for me, the absolute low point was the point we've been talking about, the early 2000s, actually. The moment when, the moment of the Gulf War. I think Occupy did start, you know, for example, represented a slow, you know, step on the path to recovery, just because the culture around Occupy was actually a lot more open than that kind of activist culture of the early 2000s.
Mm.
I think 2011, as Keir has said, was really important. You know, Corbynism is really important. I'm not massively optimistic. I'm not massively optimistic about the short term, just for the same reason. To me, it feels like we're still sort of 10 years away from the government we really want. But
that is the problem, is that like we have this other climate crisis pressing down on us, do you know what I mean? Which severely limits the timescale in which we can sort of think about politics.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Another person I thought we could talk about would be Janelle Monáe. It's sort of like, I suppose you'd call it sort of sci-fi soul or sci-fi psychedelic soul or something like that.
Sometimes I'm mystery, sometimes I'm free, depending on my mood or my attitude. Sometimes I wanna roll or stay at home, walking contradiction against some factual and fiction. A little crazy, little sexy, little cool. Little rough around the edges, but I keep it smooth. I'm always left to center, and it's right where I belong. I'm the random mind and no
she's an artist who's got a shtick. She's got an alter ego, basically, which is sort of like this android called Cindy Mayweather. Is that right? So it's definitely in the sort of like Afrofuturist sort of trend or theme or history, I think.
Well, it's explicitly so.
Yeah.
I can't think of any recent example of someone who is really a mainstream pop musician like Janelle Monáe, who has this very explicitly kind of intellectual project about the work. And she's very political. She's great on Twitter. You know, her politics are really sound. I mean, it is. I mean, we're seeing the final displacement of capitalist realist hip hop as the central theme of kind of both African, you know, African-American and British sort of black music and black culture. And that is, I've said before and I'll say it again, that is a precondition for any kind of sort of revolutionary culture to reemerge.
About like aspects of the conjuncture which are not conducive to an AC project, and we've talked about some of them, but like some of the things we could talk about would be you know, there's been polls recently that that show that young people are having less sex, they're drinking less, they're taking less drugs. You know, we have to account for that, you know,
which
that,
is of
that,
great that. Concern to this radio show.
Yeah, but if we're gonna sort of come up, you know, characterize the political character of Generation Left, we'd have to account for that. You know, some of it obviously, right, is to do with, you know, the diminished material circumstances of young people. You know, they're living with their parents, they're living in their parents' house for longer, you know, cuts down the opportunities sometimes for sex and drugs, and perhaps for drinking as well. They've also got less money, of course. But like, I don't think that accounts for all of it. There's something else going on, you know, something else to do with that.
People on their phones, man. Go on, make a serious point, Jeremy.
Well, no, you're right about the phones as well. But it's also, I mean, I think it is, I mean, most of the journalistic commentary on that has linked it to people's anxiety about work, about the fact that you just can't, you have to keep yourself primed and employable, like at all times. Yeah. So you just say, and this comes back to what we talked about in the last recording we made, that sort of leisure regimes, including sort of or ideas about leisure, and including ideas about intoxication, are always tied to sort of regimes of work. And there's no question that people do experience the contemporary regime of work as deeply oppressive and intrusive. In ways which the kind of, again, the sort of post-war settlement, it really varies between different social groups and different countries, whether people are actually working more than they were like in the 60s. But the intrusion of work into every aspect of life is something that's really sort of ubiquitous. And that is something we have to kind of fight against.
I think it goes further, though, as well. And I think it is to do with that thing we were talking about earlier about, you know, the neoliberal institutions train you to be a certain form of entrepreneurial subject, you know, the entrepreneur of yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, and so, like, that spreads from work to all sorts of life where you're supposed to be working on yourself, you're supposed to be improving yourself to some degree, you know, going to the gym, etc. Now, that sort of, that creeps into people's lives, you know, even if that the response to that is some sort of collapse, you know, of like, I'm not doing anything, you know, I can't do anything. I think that must play into it, you know, and it does. It's an interesting thing about the point we raised earlier about, you know, it's a libertarian aspect of the contemporary left. How much is that influenced by the sort of entrepreneurialism of young people? And is that entrepreneurialism necessarily a bad thing, right? Can it be sort of, you know, can that sort of a level of like personal initiative, perhaps something like that, be linked to a collective project? You know, I think it probably can.
That's really interesting. I'm like part fascinated, part horrified by the potential answer coming out of that.
Well, we need a different word than entrepreneurialism, I think. I mean, I've heard people saying similar things sort of recently, but I just think you need a different word.
Yeah. I mean, Hart and Negri tried to reclaim the entrepreneurial, but I think it's probably a dead word.
But isn't it about capacity? Is that what we're saying? Is it about the capacity or is it about the imagination? Is it about saying we're not pro job for life, where you're just, you know, another cog in the machine and you don't need to think? Are we saying that there's a good aspect to, like, you know, taking control of the direction of one's life, which is the other extreme, which sounds really like capitalist and horrible and makes me like cringe at what I've just said?
Well, no, that's really good. It's a really good way of putting it. And, like, I mean, the cog in the machine that doesn't have to think, I'm always going on about this because it's really interesting. You know, Gramsci said that actually it was good from a socialist perspective that early to mid-20th century industrial capitalism made the worker just a cog in the machine who didn't have to think, because it meant they didn't have to invest any of their emotion and intellect in their work, so they could just think about, you know, revolution and reform.
But a lot of that still exists on the left. There are a lot of people, I mean, maybe not a lot, but I come across a lot of people who think, well, I do want to just have a job where, you know, I'm working at a reception or whatever, because it means that I've got more time for activism. And it's really something I've thought about, basically my whole adult life, because I've only had jobs on the left, which obviously is really rare. And I can't imagine it any other way, which is a really bizarre situation for me to be in.
I mean, we know what we want, don't we? It's neither. Like, our thing would be that we're not satisfied just with people having to just have jobs where they don't have to think, because if they did have to think, they'd just be being even more exploited. You know, that's the thing. I mean, the thing for Gramsci is you're going to be exploited. So it's better at least you don't have to think about it, because then your brain isn't being exploited. And on the other hand, we don't want a situation in which the only opportunity people get to, like, use their brains and feel creatively fulfilled is like doing marketing for breakfast cereals, which is still a really big thing. You know, that is still a really big thing with lots of, you know, young people today. Is they think, you know, that is... They want to go work in marketing or something, because it's the only way they can imagine actually being creatively fulfilled
and being paid and being able to survive. Yeah, because you can't.
We don't want either. I mean, that's why we do support, you know, sort of fully automated luxury communism. You know, we do want the demand for full automation as a socialist demand, to the point that it liberates people from drudgery. But we also want a politics which makes sure that doesn't just become an opportunity for capitalist exploitation.
And I think part of the libertarian thing as well is accepting, and I don't think this is something we talk about much, is, you know, that regardless of which way you come at this with, people are different in that sense. There will just be some people who want to have the same job, which they don't have to think about. And there are other people who they want their job to be the most creative space possible. And we want to facilitate that, but mostly have the space for everything in between.
And you're right, actually. Well, that does come to one of the potential problems, actually, that we're supposed to be talking about with AC, is that it does potentially belong to a certain kind of bohemian, artistic kind of left tradition, which sort of assumes everyone wants to be an artist, you know. And I think you're right, it's a good point that, yeah, we don't want to just reproduce that discourse. Although I would say, we've sort of said this in the past before, I don't think the AC project is for everyone. I think the project is for everyone, maybe it is, to the extent that we can accept that. We can accept that you shouldn't have to be kind of dynamic and creative, like, if you don't want to be. You should have the opportunity. Everybody should have the opportunity. And our assumption is, and the good evidence is, that loads and loads of people who want to be don't have the opportunity. But we don't want to impose it as a norm.
Absolutely. And I think we would never, though. I think that's actually what I want to come back to, which marries, like, my point with the one that you just made, Jeremy, which is that there's clearly, like, not enough space for creativity. Like, that's the deficit. And so we want to create a situation where people can have more space for, like, living a more creative life. And that won't be everyone, but we're not going to force it upon people in some kind of, you know, totalitarian thing. Like, you must be able
Maoist art camp.
Yeah, like, you must be able to do pottery, like forced pottery and like glass blowing.
Artists ruin it. They ruin it for everyone. Artists ruin it. They ruin it for everyone. Get a job, get
get a loan. Forget it, you will never own a home. In your 20s, in your 30s, in your teens, all you do is moan, moan, moan.